Omaha Public Radio presents a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Najiba Said, Associate Professor at Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California, as well as founder and director of the Center for Global Peacebuilding. She'll speak on the topic Muslim Women, Violence, and Peacemaking. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 2, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Christian Peterson, Assistant Professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Nebraska at Omaha.
We have the great privilege and honor of hosting Najiba Said, who is a professor of interreligious education at Claremont School of Theology. There, she is also the director of the Center for Global Peacebuilding. She is a recognized leader in peacebuilding, winning awards for her work in violent conflicts, ethnic confrontation, and gang violence, both nationally and internationally. She is an active scholar, social justice activist, and interreligious community leader. And we are very happy to host her. So please join me in welcoming Najiba, who will be giving a talk entitled Muslim Women, Violence, and Peacekeeping. Thank you.
Good evening. What a pleasure and an honor to be here. I decided to pick three really easy, uncomplicated, tension-free topics to talk to you about tonight. Humor is always helpful in conflict and sometimes actually creates conflict. So you have to learn how to use it effectively. But one of the things that I wanted to talk about today was how and what happens to the role of women in peacemaking, in conflicts, particularly in those that are framed around issues of religion. So I will go over some of the scholarship and also share some examples of the work that I've done in different scenarios. So one of the scholars that informs my work is Elise Boulding, and in her work, she helps us begin to define the notion of violence and peace, not just as oppositional forces or abstracted beliefs, but she talks about them as cultures. So in her work, which was very important in the beginning of peace and conflict studies, she helped us begin to think about this notion of what creates cultures of violence and what creates cultures of peace, and who animates cultures of violence and who animates cultures of peace. Because one of the areas that's lacking, I would say, in my work, particularly in the intersection of peace and religion, there is no concept more abstracted than peace. Whether theologians approach it, whether scholars approach it, whether your pastor or imam in the pulpit approaches it, whether elementary school teacher, this idea of peace. So I ask my students on the first day of peace education, I say, I want you to tell me what peace sounds like. I want you to tell me what peace looks like. I want you to tell me what peace tastes like. And sometimes they look at me and think, they might think that a few times during the class, she's a little crazy. But the point is that we have so much work to do to move peace from this abstraction into the notion of how we engage. And the other thing that Elise Boulding does in her work is she says peace is not just about interpersonal relationships. So much of peacemaking curricula focuses on this notion that if two people can just get along, everything will be fine. Dr. Boulding says, actually, it's about the individual relationships in their aggregate that create cultures of violence or cultures of peace. So it's not just about how I approach peace. It's how relationally you and I decide and engage with one another that creates or promotes cultures of peace. And I think this is a really important idea, because what we find is that peacemaking, in addition to being abstracted, in addition to being often reduced to the individual level, needs an intervention in being framed as a relational process. That my capacity to engage in peacemaking is directly related to your capacity to engage in peacemaking. And in my work, I talk about this quite a bit, this notion of interdependence, that when communities begin to move to a recognition of their interdependence, we begin to see a reduction in violence and a creation of cultures of peace. So I come from Los Angeles, and a lot of people say, well, why have you gone to Nebraska and Iowa and North Carolina in the last few years? And part of the reason is because I find in cities the size of Omaha that actually it's interdependence that is more recognized in smaller venues. And similarly, when I travel around the world, there is an assumption that peacemaking happens when there's a vast amount of diversity and a large population. But actually, interdependence is more recognized in communities that are smaller, in communities where people get to know one another. So I had the honor earlier of having dinner with partners who were doing work on the Tri-Faith Initiative. I actually teach that as a case study. The Harvard Pluralism Project holds up Omaha as an example of interfaith relations. So you all didn't know that. You didn't know that Harvard's taking your story and that I teach it to students from all over the world. So I wanted to just start with that because I think this idea of cultures of violence and cultures of peace allows us to look at the factors that are human related. It allows us to look at the factors that are related to the media that is playing a role in a conflict. It allows us to pay attention to the role of religion. But it also says not all conflicts are created by one cause. Religion is not the cause of every conflict. Or in another way to see it, one group may have the capacity for violence, but it also has the capacity for peace. One group has the capacity to engage in conflict resolution and then also play the other role. So this idea of cultures of violence and cultures of peace. So that's Elise Boulding's first scholarly intervention that I think really helps us think about peacemaking. So now I wanted to talk a little bit about women as peacemakers. In conflicts all over the world, guess who crosses enemy lines first? In almost every conflict. Women, particularly which women? Whether it's conflicts in Los Angeles, conflicts in Minnesota, where mothers have lost their children. So in conflicts all over the world, whether it's Northern Ireland or Guatemala, it's actually mothers that are the first to do that act of peacemaking. But guess who is at the table when there's a negotiation of these conflicts? Who is represented at the table? Men. So we have initiatives internationally that are beginning to look at the formal actors who are making decisions in nearly every single peace negotiation. In this year, it is still men who are at the table. And it is still, who are most of the informal peace actors? Women. And this is really interesting because it goes across ethnic, class, racial, and religious lines. I do peacemaking work all over the world, as you can see, and it has struck me that this is a consistent theme, and it's also a problematic theme. So when we talk about women in peacemaking, the representation in the cultures and the production of cultures of peace mean women must also be at the table in the negotiation for peace. Because what happens if you negotiate a peace, not just with 50-something percent of the population not at the table, but those that actually implement the peace, you really create an agreement that's not implementable. I don't know if that's a word. You guys can Google it. So that, as we would talk about in the area of peace education, its durability is heavily in question. It's not going to last. And that would be one of my critical responses to a lot of agreements that are made in conflicts where those that are actually doing the work on the ground are not the ones that are often engaged. So Janine Hill Fletcher and Atin Anwar and others have written about this notion of peacemaking and mothers as peacemakers. So I encourage you to look at that work because it's a body of work that in Atin's work is focused on Muslim women, Jeanine Hill Fletcher is a Catholic theologian. So this is a phenomenon that is being seen in multiple religious traditions, since part of what we're going to talk about today. But I wanted to point that out because, again, it's this notion, if we think of cultures of peacemaking, then we have to engage those that are producers of cultures of peacemaking. So it's not just about the individual level, but it's looking at the structures. So what are some of the assets that we find when women are engaged in peacemaking processes? So what's fascinating in my work is I actually found that when women have less formal power, they have had to negotiate with very few resources. So their capacity to see an alternative to violence is actually heightened. Because if you have access to power and access to inflict violence, you're less likely often to think about peace as an option. Does that make sense to everyone? This is just a basic, and you can look at the scholarship. But it's fascinating to me that if I'm able to work in spaces, that sometimes it's about having to build an informal power base. So when I worked by the way, I don't refer to it as gang intervention in my work. I call it urban peacemaking, because the peacemakers in the cities across the United States are doing the same kind of work that people who are getting Nobel Prizes in other countries. A lot of times we don't recognize peacemakers here in our own space. But, you know, when I was doing that kind of work, I'm sorry, the cold weather is giving me a cough. I'm a very delicate Angelino from Los Angeles who brought a, you know, like this tropical flower is wilting and coughing here in Omaha. But the gentleness and the warmth that I've experienced is keeping me from coughing too much. So what is really interesting is that in that work, what I would find is, you know, it wouldn't be the city council member that would be the peacemaker per se or have that power. It would be the grandmother who in her house could have people from different rival gangs work with one another. So you can take that example all over the world. When you don't have the formal power, maybe you don't have the pulpit religiously, but you've developed some form of informal authority. And particularly in conflict resolution, one of the most important powers is the power of convening. And what does that mean by the power of convening? That means when you ask people to show up, they actually show up. And that's a huge power. And it's not a power that's easily built on. And so I found very much and very often working with women in the peacemaking sector and those that are trying to prevent violence, that power of convening was something that is built, again, on relational cultures of peacemaking. So that power, if that mother, if that community leader may ask people to come together, if you have formal authority, why are people incentivized to come together? Because usually they have some way of enforcement, right? But when people have developed, when women have developed that capacity for peacemaking, they are able to convene people because they actually want to be there. That's a huge difference. And it's going to change the way a peacemaking process happens. If people are there, if you're here at my lecture tonight because you're obligated for class, I don't know if you may be, that is a very different, everyone's like, not me. That's a very different kind of being in a space than if you were really coming to the space, and maybe they're not mutually exclusive. Maybe you're required to come and you were super excited. But when you come voluntarily, then that's a very different kind of convening. So that's a really powerful thing that I wanted to talk about, is a lot of times the deficit of power is viewed as, why should we engage women in peacemaking? They don't have the power. If I had a dime, I feel like now we're in 2017, it's probably a dollar. My kids don't even want to keep pennies around. They don't think they're really worth it. I see a penny and I pick it up. They're like, Mama, that doesn't mean anything these days. If I had a dime or a dollar, every time I saw a picture of a male imam, a rabbi, a pastor, standing behind and saying, we have now declared peacemaking of whatever this conflict is, what is that doing? What is that telling? What is the story of that peacemaking process? It is representing not just one part of the population, but it is also showing us or bringing to us a notion that women are invisible as peacemakers. And a lot of my work has been to visibilize the peacemaking work of women. So I think it's very problematic, and this is where a critical gendered lens is very important, this notion of peacemaking not just in formal negotiations that are sponsored by either by states or by NGOs, but also in religious settings. When we see the male leadership as the only ones that are brokering peace, I think that tells us a very skewed perspective of peacemaking processes. So the other thing I wanted to talk about were some of the areas that peacemaking has grown, particularly with women in the United States, that I have been studying. And one of them has been a lot of activism on domestic violence in the Muslim community. And I think that that has been, so what we now call intimate violence, this notion of violence happening in the home. There are, in most cities in the United States, organizations now that are addressing this issue. So part of what I'm speaking to you about tonight are entrees into the world of peacemaking. And I think that this is really important because one of the things that happens is that violence against women's bodies is one of the forms of violence that is part of cultures of violence. So if someone has experienced domestic violence as a child, has watched violence in the home, their repetition of violence and a cycle of violence is almost, the percentage is very high. So part of preventing violence in those intimate relationships is building cultures of peace. Because if violence against women's bodies, if the place where a woman feels the most unsafe is her own home, which is sadly statistically the case very often in our country, and not just with Muslim women but across cultures, then it creates an environment in which permissibility of violence against women's bodies is acceptable. And that's where the work of religious scholars has been very important. Because the religious scholars can make a choice. They can support what? A culture of violence, an interpretation of the tradition that actually doesn't just give permission for violence, but encourages it. Or they can do the work, I think Dr. Peterson was teaching some of the scholars in his class. There has been a robust interpretation of religious texts to galvanize movements and organizations against intimate violence. And again, it's not just that interpersonal peace. It's not the effect on that one home. It's the collective generational impact of cultures of violence. So I think we're seeing scholars in the United States and also in other places across the world that are looking particularly at religious texts and unpacking first the problem of violence and then at the second level engaging religious texts to be antidotes to violence. And I think that's quite a fascinating development in the scholarship around violence. Another thing I wanted to talk about was this notion of masculinities. So scholars have been talking about the connection between violence and construction of masculinity. So Enlow's work says that nationalism springs from masculinized memories, masculinized humiliation, and masculinized hope. And Nagel, who comments on her work, says, she argues, Enlow, that women are relegated to minor, often symbolic roles in nationalist movements and conflicts, either as icons of nationhood to be elevated and defended, or as the booty of spoils of war to be denigrated and disgraced. In either case, the real actors are the men who are defending their freedom, their honor, their homeland, and their women. Thistlethwaite goes on in her work, she's a mentor of mine, and talks about this notion of what happens when we begin to weaponize religion and create masculinities that are based on not just violence against women, but increased cultures of violence. So the reasons that this is important is that we know in many conflicts, One of the weapons of war has been the violation of women's bodies through sexual assault. And that is not a new piece of information. Throughout histories, this has been a major issue, that part of the process of violence, part of the way of attacking the honor, as Enlow and others would say, was the violation of women's bodies. And now we're beginning to, since the last 15 years, 20 years, see in international law some protection, and looking at how that act is particularly a crime of war and engaging that. For many years, it was an accepted result of war. It was this notion that when there is violence, that is what happens to a city. That's what happens in those environments. And so one of the things that when we talk about cultures of violence and cultures of peace, particularly with a religious intervention, is how are masculinities being constructed by religious actors, religious leaders, and religious scholars? If masculinities are being constructed in such a way that they promote a whole culture of violence against women, then that means we're going to see an increased use of religion, and religion becomes weaponized as a major tool to perpetrate violence. And I think this is an issue that we hopefully will begin to explore more and more, because very often the conversation around religion and peacemaking puts the burden of transformation on women, puts the burden of change on women, puts the notion that violence will be eradicated on women. And what we need to begin to do is have a conversation about how masculinities are being constructed in these spaces. And I think there's more and more scholarship on this, and the role of religious text and scholarship and leaders, the use of pulpits as well, are those spaces in which the valorization of a masculinity that is based on violence against women's bodies, whether it's individually or collectively, is a question that I think is a question that brings to bear, and that more and more scholars are beginning to look at the construction of masculinity in different religious traditions. So I think that's an open question in the space of the conversation that we've talked about tonight. So I wanted to pose that as a scholarly question, this notion of what it means to construct the intersection of religion, violence, and masculinities, and honor in particular. So the other thing I want to leave you with some voices for hope. So some of the pieces that I'm explaining to you some of the things that I see in conflicts, and also the scholarship out there in religion and peacemaking that I don't think is emphasized enough. I think we need to consider that more and more. So some of the places that I've seen that's really powerful have been women as interfaith leaders. And we see interfaith spaces all over the world. And it's been interesting, because what I've found is when women sometimes go out of their religious space into another religious space, they develop a social capital. So when you have together religion, different religions at the table, and women are represented, they actually are able to bring to that conversation a social capital that they create in the interfaith space. So actually in the United States, again, as we talked about that representation of the story of who's doing interfaith relations, think about who's doing a lot of the active interfaith work around the world or in one's community. Very often, again, it's women. And so one of the benefits that we're seeing to that is women are developing an embodied theology of religious pluralism. So we're seeing women who are able to engage with other religious traditions. So some of the leaders that I've seen in the Muslim community in the United States, as I'm studying and interviewing some of them, is that their ability to move into the interfaith space gives them also the skills and the capacity to move back into their own religious space with more authority. Does that make sense to everyone? And then sometimes you go to another religious space and you see a woman in some leadership role, And she's of your tradition, but she's being recognized by another religious tradition. What does that do? It's kind of a public shaming to think about how women in your own tradition are being treated. Does that make sense? So the intervention, the interreligious intervention that we have with one another can actually bolster religious leadership in the different communities. It's a fascinating effect. Sometimes it's the optics, right? Seeing a woman speak from another pulpit can often make us go back to our own space and say, wait, why is that not happening? Or wait, you mean you women have to be at this dialogue because another community is bringing women? Does that make sense? So there's this parity of representation is also one of the great, I would say, central pieces of how interreligious engagement is actually furthering women, and in particular, since the topic is tonight, Muslim women, and not just as actors, but also as scholars. Scholars who are being asked, why in your tradition do you do interreligious engagement? So women are having to answer questions. Women are having to go back to the text, and that also really pushes spiritual inquiry, but also spiritual authority. One is being asked that question. Another area that we're seeing quite growth is women as campus leaders across the United States. Whenever I speak at campuses around the United States, Muslim women playing a role, particularly in interfaith space, but also as campus leaders. And we have a new phenomenon in the United States. There are now a couple of different institutions where women can study to be chaplains. So they may not have the formal religious authority, but they have now a campus-based religious authority. So you have now the chaplain at Northwestern, a chaplain, there are several schools that have Muslim female chaplains, and they may be the only chaplain. So what happens when the only religious chaplain on your campus is a Muslim woman? That's going to influence as well how leadership and peacemaking can happen. So you combine this notion of someone who is an interfaith space, but also is now vested with some spiritual authority, not necessarily by their religious community, but actually by a campus-based community. And we're seeing, I think, a really fascinating turn of work that will happen in the next generation. So I wanted to point out women as campus leaders and really encourage you on this campus to think about what is happening interreligiously between different traditions. And I think that that's a chapter that is hopefully more scholars will write about, but this authority that is vested as a campus leader. So it could be as a chaplain. We're also seeing a lot of Muslim student organizations around the country having female leaders being elected. So when I go to speak at different campuses, the person who's heading the organization that is designated to the Muslim community will be a young woman. And that's also changing the optics of religious leadership. And many of them are playing major roles in interreligious peacemaking. They may be a chaplain, they may be head of a Muslim organization, or they may be a social justice leader on campus. So this idea of Muslim women coming into spaces of authority in the campus community and in large percentages, not just as the actors and the workers, but as the visible leaders coming to the table, is bringing this notion of the campus community as a space that fosters Muslim women as peacemakers. So tonight, a lot of what I'm trying to talk about is very descriptive about what's happening, and maybe later we can talk about what can happen. Internationally, we're seeing a rise in Muslim women as global development experts. So the organizations like Women for Women, organizations and people like Zainab Salbi and others who are beginning to bring their work may not be religious in nature, their work may not be focused just on the Muslim community, but they're doing international development work. And more, they're becoming actors around peacemaking and negotiation. Because conflict is caused really by competition for resources, whatever those resources may be. We were talking about earlier in dinner, we know the next 30 years, it used to be that oil was one of the major causes of conflict. Now we know water. Water will be, and access to potable or drinkable water is going to be probably one of the major sources of conflict, both nationally and internationally. And so when we have actors in those spaces who are women, again, the way we construct religion has to be able to be to identify religious actors that may not be religious leaders per se. But very often literature on peacemaking and religion looks at the formal religious authority. Who is the one that is the imam in the community? So what I'm pushing you to think about is, well, what are other spaces where women are doing this work? So we're really seeing international human rights work as well. But particularly I wanted to point out development, because the lens that we're beginning to look at in development also is considering what is the best way to do development on the ground that is culturally competent. So some of these female leaders are having to engage religion, because the way one does development in a village somewhere in Afghanistan is going to be different than the way one does development in a village in Myanmar, right? So what you have to do as development moves to be contextual, these leaders are starting to have to develop religious arguments for why we do this work in this context. So suddenly those that may not have religious authority have to either work with people on the ground and also articulate, why am I doing this work? And in societies where religion is at play, it means that we're seeing interpretations that support engagement of women as actors, not just in religious spaces, but in spaces of development. So I wanted to point that out. I think the intersection between religion, development, and how Muslim women are creating both scholarship and leadership related to religion is another fascinating conversation. Think about people like Malala Yousafzai. She's a young girl, right? It's not just the symbol of her, but it's her actual engagement in these spaces. She's not a religious leader to whom one would get a religious edict, but she has to engage her cultural context, which means inevitably she's engaging religion. And so I wanted to point that out. Particularly, this is another area that women are doing work is as educators. So a lot of times there is this notion, and Saba Mahmood in her work, Politics of Piety, talks about education in Muslim communities being spaces of ethical cultivation. Usually ethics is seen as happening in a political space. Ethics is seen as happening somewhere where someone who has power makes authority. But what Saba Mahmood's work tells us, you know what, just as Elise Boulding works tells us, that actually what women are doing is profoundly impactful. I hate that word because I don't think it's really a word. Impactful. It has great impact. So what women are doing in engaging, we know that in most religious institutions in the United States, for instance, who is in charge of the education of young Muslims? Mostly it's women. And in many conflict scenarios around the world, it's also women. And there's a undervaluing of the notion of that role of education. The more feminized or the more women that are in a profession, we talk about the pink collar professions, often they're not valued by economic indices or even socially valued. So this notion of women as educators and the profound impact that they have and the capacity to form peacemakers is something that I've been looking at in my work as well. The curricular decisions that are made for education, the training that educators receive. So whether it's at the religious school level or at the graduate level, someone like me as a professor, what role are actors playing in educational spaces? And how does that give them the social capital and the intellectual capital, again, to engage the tradition in ways that have to project it into a potential impact for peacemaking? So there are two other spaces that I'm going to talk about that I think are really important, and one of them is this notion of women in business and entrepreneurship. So Ambassador John McDonnell and Louise Diamond have a really wonderful book called and focused on multi-track diplomacy. It used to be that diplomacy was viewed at this level, at the governmental level. Then we began to see track two diplomacy. Then Louise and Ambassador John McDonnell began to bring another six layers of interaction of religious leaders, artists, but also they began to talk about peace through commerce. And one of the places I've seen profound impact of women is in nearly every cultural situation, women as entrepreneurs. Not just women working for large corporations, but women who are taking control, whether it be through works such as microlending and programs like that, but women in multiple cultural settings taking on the role of commerce. And this, I think, is going to be something that we have to begin to have conversations about, because just as women were very often the first to cross the lines in conflict, I would imagine, looking at some of this from the scholarly historical perspective, that women across boundaries are going to collaborate business-wise as well, too. So we see in some conflicts around the world, women from different sides not necessarily getting together and doing reconciliation work, but actually starting business projects together. Because they're able to, and particularly entrepreneurs, I would encourage you to look at the literature on entrepreneurship, because there's something about running your own business. And what's fascinating is a lot of them will often do a business that's related to their religious identity to start with. So the Muslim fashion industry, it's blown up all over the world. I can't use that word. It has increased and expanded. Sorry, the misinterpretation of that phrase. What I meant to say is you'll see spaces where entrepreneurs, it's not just those that are doing social justice or peacemaking work, but I think the literature around interreligious peacemaking is through commerce and through those that are entrepreneurs is one that is a very promising area. So places like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, places like some of the conflicts in Southeast Asia or South Asia, those that are able to begin to develop businesses, and we see this already, women are working across lines. The last place that I'm going to mention is the area of social media. One of my articles is actually tracing women who were using Facebook as a tool during some of the Arab revolutions. And it was fascinating to me because I thought as I was doing the research and looking at, it was fun. I was on Facebook and then my kids were like, why are you on Facebook? I was like, it's my job right now. So the best thing is research something that you enjoy because then it's like an excuse to do it all the time. So one thing I found in the social media space was that women were using social media space, because if you didn't, again, have formal authority, this is a place where your social capital is built upon your self-representation, and it's literally quantifiable. If someone has 100,000 followers, that is a rubric that I can measure, right? I can now, and even the tools, since I wrote the article, it was about 6 or 7 years ago, the tools are even better for the rubrics. And so women are animating their self-representation and building social capital to be able to engage as peacemakers, because one thing that is central to peacemaking is one must have some social capital. And why is that? Because you must be someone that is seen as trustworthy. You must be someone that is seen as having the capacity to resolve a conflict, right? So it doesn't mean you can walk in a room without any form of some recognizable authority. Some people come to it through spiritual authority. Some people come to that capacity through moral authority as social justice leaders. And others are coming into this space literally through social media, right? There are folks for whom the capacity to get to be recognized, and part of it is how you tell your story. And again, the control of women's bodies, that I, as I talked about earlier, is a major factor. And so here, Here, the notion of how a Muslim woman can self-represent is powerful, but it's also what happens when you begin to have conversations across boundaries. And what was so fascinating to me in looking at different and tracing social media use in a couple of different countries, and I share this with one of the folks I was talking to yesterday, it wasn't that women were actually often translating their social media presence into their own social capital in their own life, but it was the camaraderie that they felt with other women in their struggle towards women's rights. So you were seeing users of Facebook in places like Egypt, talking to users of Facebook in places like Saudi Arabia, talking to users of Facebook in Algeria, talking to users of Facebook in Mexico. So here, and what was fascinating is that they all had different struggles. And so I thought it would be that you have all this followership, you go back to your community and you organize, but it was that I am not alone. I am not alone in the struggle. And then you saw, again, people were actually, I don't know how to quite call this yet in my work, doing Facebook theology, right? No, I'm really serious in social media. Because, like, you know, it could be that you wait for some religious leader to give you a tome and decision. But women were like, so, how have you been able to articulate why it's important for women to drive? Why have you been able to articulate why it's important for women to be able to get married without needing permission of whatever? So you saw Facebook theology happening. People are theologizing on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter's hard. It's like 140 characters. I would love for all theologians to use Twitter because it's like super quick, right? You don't have to read like a 600-page decision on something. So it's also, not only are they doing theology, but they're crossing state boundaries when states may be heavily limiting their rights, right? So it's fascinating to me, this social media space, because I also don't think it's the antidote to everything. I think it's only a tool, because one of the other things I did find out in my research is that sometimes by leaders who had only a social media presence is that they weren't able to articulate and work in spaces where there was no social media. The percentages in the use of social media in some of these countries was actually very low, the digital divide. So you could have a strong presence among an elite, well-educated segment of the population, but when it came to actual social change, if you were not out in the rural areas and didn't have capacity to engage people, you had what we would call in social media research thin relationships. You had many relationships, but the relationships are thin in social media. So what I mean by that is the actual interaction can be one that may not have behavioral changes because it's a thin relationship. So there's research on that too. But what was so fascinating to me was this Facebook theology. And I asked people, what was your, you know, where did you get some of these religious interpretations? And people are getting them off of social media. You know, it's become a space where many people don't just go for their news, but they go for advice about their life. And it was really interesting to me that one of the aspects that women, as they describe what they were doing, they were saying that part of the reason they wanted to be and were engaging in this religious interpretation was they felt empowered to do so through not just how other people recognize them through social media, but they felt themselves empowered in their self-image. So anyways, I think those were just some descriptive pieces that I wanted to talk about, and I will open up the floor to my colleagues who will animate the rest of the conversation today, if I wasn't animated enough. Thank you. It's an honor and a pleasure.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the University of Nebraska at Omaha on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Najiba Saeed, associate professor at Claremont School of Theology in Claremont, California, as well as founder and director of the Center for Global Peacebuilding. She spoke on the topic Muslim Women, Violence, and Peacemaking. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 2nd, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Ramazan Kalinch, Associate Professor of Political Science and Co-Director of the Islamic Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.